Hello, and welcome to the Crisis of Civilization podcast. I'm Dean Puckett. I'm the director of the documentary The Crisis of Civilization. And you can find me and my other film work at deaddeanfilms.co.uk. I'm here today with Nafees Mosaddegh Ahmed, the author of The User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Our podcast today is going to focus on a new article that Nafees is writing about the FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. Nafees, maybe you could just tell the listeners who Sybil Edmonds is and a little bit about her.
Sybil Edmonds is a former FBI translator who was contracted by the FBI to translate intelligence that they had been developing in the years prior to and up to 9/11. And she specializes in kind of in Persian, Turkish, Azerbaijani languages. And she got her job shortly, a couple of weeks after the 9/11 attacks, when the FBI was kind of obviously scrambling to develop a kind of big picture understanding of what the hell had happened, and had realized that their language capabilities were pretty dismal and they needed to bring new people in. So Sybil Edmonds began working for the FBI towards, you know, I think it was late September, she actually got the contract in 2001. And she worked with them for about 6 months or so. And then she ended up being fired. And what subsequently emerged from all of this experience that she had at the FBI was a spate of quite shocking revelations about high-level corruption in the US national security system, starting at the lowest levels of the FBI in the Washington field office where she was working, going all the way up to the Pentagon, the US State Department, the CIA, the Justice Department, the US Cabinet, as well as congressmen from both parties. And it was a really, really entrenched web of corruption that she'd uncovered.
And in researching this article, you've had a long recorded Skype chat with her, which we'll cut to intermittently through the podcast.
So I'm recording now.
Okay.
You are the most gagged woman in American history. And I mean, arguably, probably the most gagged person, you know, in modern times. It's really amazing. What is it about what you discovered in this? Was it about 7 months, 9 months, or something? You were working for the FBI. What was it that you discovered that was so explosive that you brought the entire machinery of the US government on your head?
Let me start with my languages. My primary language is Turkish. The secondary language, it would be almost equal, is Farsi, the language spoken in Iran. And because of that, I'm also able to, not as a verbatim pro, but I understand a lot of Dari language. Dari language is about 80%. It's like a Persian Farsi dialect. Azerbaijani is because of my father's background, and of course English, because both I studied in English in Turkey, but then I came and I went to universities here. My degrees is very simple. I have two bachelor's degrees. I have one in criminal psychology, the other one in criminal justice from George Washington University. Yeah, you're right. They consider this classified. But then I got a master's degree in public policy, U.S. public policy from George Mason University. And my work background up until the work that I did with the FBI, I never worked for the government. I did some volunteer work for the criminal justice system in Virginia, for juvenile court in Alexandria. I dealt with sexually abused children. And other than that, it's been private business. I traveled extensively until 2000. I had one job temporarily in Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union, 1992, 1993, with Rostropovich Foundation, which dealt with children hospitals in back then Leningrad, St. Petersburg. Now, with the FBI, I want to emphasize, like, I did not discover anything by myself. myself.
Yeah.
These investigations, operations were ongoing since 1996 and not through one field office. That was where I work, FBI Washington, D.C. field office, but also FBI field offices elsewhere, especially specifically in Chicago. And these discoveries and all the suspicions of some of the activities that later through investigation produced explosive results were being carried out long before I joined the FBI. But what happened was, since it was right after 9/11, and since these different field offices and different operations being separated both through bureaucracy, but also intentionally, for example, FBI, Turkish counterintelligence could not talk with or share information with FBI Turkish Criminal Division. And the FBI Criminal Division could not share information and work together with FBI Turkish Counterterrorism Division because of these separations, that a lot of it was intentional, some of it was due to bureaucracy. So what happened was, I came in there, and I will get into it really more in detail because it really needs to be explained how and what operations we are talking about. I ended up working, because I was the only language specialist, and up until after 9/11, 3 days after 9/11, FBI was not allowed to have an official Turkish division, whether it's counterintelligence, counterterrorism. They could carry out some monitoring under FISA and pursue some criminal investigations, but they could never have a division that is officially called Turkish division. Wow. They could never have a division that is called UK division, even though we had all the other European countries' division. We had a French division, which, you know, we monitored, when I say we, FBI analysts and translators, their embassy and attaché information, etc. Germany, we did. All, you know, South American countries, we did. Turkey, UK, and Belgium. Three countries, and to a certain extent, Azerbaijan.
Wow, so the FBI was, these four countries were
forbidden.
So these four countries had, the FBI could not, did not, was not allowed, essentially, to wiretap them. But they were.
Well, they did, but they were not given any power to pursue the results of any investigations. First of all, the divisions were not official. While the other, for example, FBI has a huge Israel division, okay? It's one of the biggest ones. You know, there's Iran and the Saudi Arabia and all the Arab-speaking nations. But then Israel has a huge division, okay? Yeah. Even though it's an official division, it has a name, the FBI Israel Counterintelligence Division, Israel Criminal Division. So they have it. They have the power to wiretap as well. But because of political reasons, FBI is always, almost 99.999%, they are forbidden, they are prevented from implementing further actions, whether it's going to courts on espionage cases or if it's criminal cases, that's due to political pressure.
Right.
Now, Turkey and UK and Belgium, the UK embassies cannot be tapped, okay? That is just a, but while you can tap completely the military attaché for, let's say, Turkey and the Turkish embassy and Turkish NGOs or Turkish lobby firms, since it is not recognized as official, and if you find incredible terrorism or espionage cases, you are in a really bad situation in terms of pursuing and doing something about it. Okay? Well, say, now, even though it's official for Israel division in the FBI, with them, with Israel, is the political pressure. Because, you know, once in a while we hear about, oh, certain wiretaps that came out and implicated a certain congresswoman on AIPAC. Well, AIPAC has known for a long time that they are being wiretapped. And it's, they're so bold. They're like, they don't care because they know that people can't take action. They are prevented by the political powers. Because who is FBI answerable to? It's the executive branch, and ultimately is answerable to the White House, okay? DOJ White House. And so while you have agents who are, let's say, within this Turkish division, they're working because they find explosive operations. you know, whether it's narcotics related or it's espionage related against Turkey. And they have actually channels to pursue it and bring these people in to justice, whether it's the U.S. counterparts or the Turkish criminals here in the United States through criminal prosecution channels. But then their hands are tied because you have the White House, which takes order from the CIA and the State Department, telling the top layer, maybe the top four or five guys. So all the agents I work with in the FBI, they were really good, and they were doing their work, okay? They were good. They were really pursuing these true, real terrorism or criminal or espionage cases. Mm. The top layer answerable to the White House and influenceable completely by the State Department, the CIA, were the ones who were coming and saying, we are shutting down this investigation. Or I give one example that may illustrate it. Besides gathering and collecting information, the agents, also FBI agents, conducted field operations. Mm. In one case, we had a Turkish target or targets several individuals under a certain operation. This one was done through Washington, D.C. field office agents. And these targets, we had information about how they were going to bring certain kilogram of heroin through what channel, and it was going to be somewhere in D.C., okay? Hmm. And the field operation, the FBI, and also DEA, this is Drug Enforcement Agency, also was included because this was a joint operation, right? So that morning at 9:15, this particular thing was going to take place, and the DEA agents and the FBI agents, they were having this field operation, and they were going to bust these guys, okay? So they are actually in a van, several SUVs. This is the FBI agents, the DEA agents. And about 15, 20 minutes before the bust, the FBI headquarters, and this is the top, you know, SES level, senior executive level, they contact the field agents in the van, and they say, you call it off. You turn around and you get the DA agents off. This is called off. Now, agents are pissed. They are like, what? How could this be? I mean, we have all the stuff, and we cannot give you any explanation. This is the two of the targets have diplomatic immunities. Well, we knew that they were not diplomats, okay? But FBI says, no, well, somebody in the top-level FBI had shared that information with people in the State Department. Mm. So between the State Department and the White House, the director's office was being told to call off the operation. Turn around. You're not making this bust. This operation is terminated at this point, ASAP. Mm. You're returning back to the field office.
What? So when was this incident?
Well, this is one of many incidents. This particular incident took place in, it would be around end of October 2001. But again, the agents I work with, I mean, and with the files operations, not only on these particular guys, but other connected target guys, they have had similar things happening to them over and over and over since the beginning of this particular operation in 1996.
These targets were related to this particular operation to investigate. What was the investigation? What were these investigations about?
Well, this investigation, FBI's part was they were after these guys because they also had some operation centers in New Jersey, and they brought in, you know, heroin.
Out of the slime and darkness it comes to inflict its life-destroying poison on the careless, the unwary, the unprotected. No sane person would deliberately expose himself to its venom. No intelligent person would venture within striking distance of its fangs. Yet today, young people are flirting with a poison every bit as deadly as that of the snake.
And this heroin went from the source of heroin, I'm not going to go all the way to the original source, but from Turkey to Belgium, from Belgium into the United States.
Yeah.
Okay? And, well, let's say if you had four targets, foreign targets, okay, and let's say one of them had a green card but still had dual citizenship, and out of these four targets, two of them were directly connected to Pentagon and the military attaché of Turkey, but they didn't have diplomatic titles.
I see.
So you have a case where there are people who are working with Pentagon, NATO, and the Turkish military attaché who are bringing heroin into the United States. DEA knows about it, the good agents. The FBI knows about it. They want to go and make a bus because this guy doesn't have an official diplomatic cover. But yet, the State Department, aka CIA, and the White House, they tell that you terminate this operation. Because what's going to happen? You arrest these guys, this thing comes out, their identities, who they are, the operations. Now you're implicating high-level Turkish military, NATO, and the United States operations military operators. Can you imagine what would happen?
What you're saying is that one of the reasons it seems that this was blocked was because people inside the US government at a senior level actually condoned in some way this criminal activity, this heroin trafficking and all the rest of it. They were actually in some way involved, and they didn't want that involvement to come to light through this operation. Is that...
Not only that they were involved, they actually participated.
Yeah.
We had well-documented investigation cases that showed a lot of heroin entered the United States through a military plane that landed in Andrews Air Force Base. Okay, one of my whistleblowers, John Cole, he was one of the managers for the counterintelligence, okay, in FBI headquarters. Well, he tried to blow the whistle.
Wow.
Okay, so you have, it's not that, okay, they know, but because they are allies and they are having other use for us, we look the other way. No, that was not the case. It was, see, this is the whole thing. After I came back from Vietnam, there's a guy who was one of the top attorneys with the Justice Department, not the FBI. And he retired in 2005, 2006. He's not a whistleblower or anything, and he's like one of the system guy. And he said, you know what, Sabel? That's one of the mistakes, I believe, the DOJ and the State Department, because the decision for the state secrets privilege didn't originate from the FBI. The DOJ implemented it, but the decision came from the State Department, CIA, that they needed to enforce state secrets privilege. My case had to be stopped from any, you know, proceeding in courts. But he said that was their biggest mistake because they panicked, okay? Hmm. But with what you know and what you could have taken out, even though you were not supposed to document-wise from the FBI, that if they let you just talk and take this stuff out there, nobody would have believed anyway.
Yeah.
So they actually made a big tactical mistake because they even gave more attention in some ways and legitimacy by saying we cannot let her open her mouth.
Yeah.
You let her open her mouth. Well, if I had really gone to court and testified under oath, then I would have said something like, okay, here is the particular office in Pentagon and here is a particular office in the State Department. And this is the division within NATO which is part of it is the Turkish division of NATO because Turkey is a NATO ally. And they're engaged in this, including heroin. Nobody would have believed me. It would have sounded insane.
The situations that you're describing here, when you go into detail in your book and you explain all of the various strands of investigations that you ended up translating intelligence in relation to, there is this, they really are just small facets of this web of criminal activity. On the one hand, some of it was just there was bureaucracy, and there was what you might expect in any organization. There's a lot of bureaucracy and blah blah blah, red tape. But then there were other layers. So the next layer that I thought was interesting was this kind of criminal negligence.
It comes down to this: we're faced with an enemy who are determined to destroy us, and we have no hope of negotiating a peace unless that changes. We are justified in doing anything we can to survive.
Now he had the war he wanted. I shall give a propagandist reason, he confided. The victor is not asked if he told the truth.
This is essentially the same crowd that brought you Desert Storm 10 years ago, particularly Secretary Powell, Vice President Cheney, and of course, President Bush, the son of then President Bush.
For example, let me give you, let me start with three things, three points, so that way everything will start maybe making more sense. You just mentioned translation, and I want to also clarify something else here. So let's say you are wiretapping or monitoring a military attaché, Turkish military attaché, and let's say embassy, right? Well, sure, there will be communications that are in Turkish between Turkish actors, targets, right? Some of them are non-targets who are just calling, and you by default hear it, and you know, you're the translator, you translate it. But I would say close to 40-50% of those communications didn't have to be translated because they were carried out in English, okay? So when wiretap brings this information to the FBI, it doesn't distinguish which ones are in English, which ones are in Turkish. Now, the targets may be Turkish or Pakistanis, but a lot of conversations are in English. One example of this would be there was a very heated period between summer 2001, and these are both archive and later live monitoring, where on daily basis we sat and listened to Paul Wolfowitz talking to the top military attaché guy, you know, Turkish military attaché, okay, on Iraq. This was before we invaded Iraq. And there were a lot of discussions, there was a lot of, they were trying to get, and this is Paul Wolfowitz, the Turkish military saying, this was actually plans on going and invading Iraq, and Turkey, in order to have U.S. use the base, etc., they had one condition, one important condition Turkey was putting there and demanding was like, you let us handle northern Iraq, you know, the whole Kirkuk region, because we have our own interests there with the Kurds and everything. Well, the plan was only United States and United Kingdom. And they said, well, you don't do that, we're not going to let you use our damn base. And the middle guys, they're not the top guys, Wolfowitz, were trying to get this thing mild and saying, come on now, look, initially we will do it, but within the first few years, then we would let you to participate in some of the stuff, you know, with Iraq. But initially, we do not want to have that kind of a mess in the northern border. Well, so what I'm trying to say is all this conversation was in English. They didn't need a translator, but it came through the same cable, through the same wiretap. So to hear almost on daily basis Richard Pearl or Paul Wolfowitz talking to the highest level guy in Turkish embassy was a regular occurrence. And agents were able to directly listen to it too. And when you listen, I mean, so much you were finding out that was just mind-boggling. Now, the most troubling, the most important aspect of this case, the state secrets privilege, ended up tying directly to 9/11.
Yeah.
Because the previous, some of them, they were shut down. That's why I'm referring to as previous investigations. They were shut down by the end of 2001, early 2002. Investigations produced all these evidence. Documented evidence in the FBI that made it very clear that we, the United States, up until 2001, including at the time of 9/11, we had very close joint operations with Ayman Zawahiri, with Bin Laden, not only one Bin Laden, several Bin Laden family members, including Osama Bin Laden. Okay, we had meetings with them. Yeah. In Baku, in Azerbaijan, the U.S. Embassy in Azerbaijan in Baku.
When did those meetings take place?
So there were at least three or four meetings, two of them with Zawahiri. And we had actually from U.S. people going and attending that meeting in the U.S. Embassy, including people such as Prince Bandar was in there. We had several known Turkish figures 1997, 1998, the last one being in late 1999 in Azerbaijan, in Baku, in U.S. Embassy.
And the Turkish figures, were they, those were military intelligence or government? Who were these people?
This was, well, one of them was the highest level Turkish general, that is the NATO, Turkish NATO general.
I see.
But also it included a very high-level religious figure, which maybe we'll get into it later. This made the entire thing with 9/11 and what the government was saying completely moot.
They can't stand free. The evildoers, they can't stand free. Taliban, they can't stand free.
The fanatics,
they can't stand free. They hate what America stands for.
Freedom and democracy. Freedom and democracy.
These beliefs are the foundation of our civilized world.
And once they gain a foothold, they cannot be stopped.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
You know, she worked for the FBI, and she witnessed and experienced cover-ups, misuses of power, and things which cast the whole story about what we know about 9/11 in a different light, and that ultimately trying to get that information out to the public, she has been completely suppressed.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that, I mean, the information that she brings to light is not exclusively related to 9/11.
Okay.
Or even just to terrorism, although obviously it focuses on that because of the time that she was employed. And because of some of the way in which the information she uncovered overlapped with the events of 9/11 and related types of events. So I think it's important not to narrowly pigeonhole her as, for example, a 9/11 whistleblower or something. So it's really a massive and complex web of things that she brings to the fore, which is why I think it's important that people actually read her book and understand how complex the things are, but also how ridiculously facile the picture is that is presented to us in the media about terrorism.
I've taken a lot of heat for saying it goes back to the Crusades.
Barely 100 years after Muhammad's death, the Islamic Empire had spread far and wide. The Pope reacted to the Muslim expansion by launching Christendom's version of holy wars, the Crusades.
And you can just see it happening again.
This kind of, quote, clash of civilizations.
And this could be a defining moment.
That the world needs to march forward.
To deal with the scourge of
the bearded ones.
And see what they have done against mankind.
Because it's only going to happen with all of us together.
The message to Muslim nations and moderate Arabs, Pakistan also, is
we hold our beliefs every bit as strongly as they hold theirs. And now is the time to show it.
A huge lack of self-reflection about what went wrong with these systems, and a projection outwards onto these bad guys, and it's all their fault and they're evil and they hate our freedoms.
Yeah.
Whereas what Sybil's getting into is actually how those bureaucracies work and function, the problems with them, the corruptions within them. But people don't, the mainstream doesn't really want to look at that. They prefer the simple narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I one of the things that came out when I was working on the story was the stuff that she brings out is so big, it's actually probably the biggest scandal that's ever happened in the United States, and yet it's happened under the radar with nobody really knowing about it. I mean, what, you know, we look at what's happening with Bradley Manning, which is absolutely atrocious. We look at what's happening with Julian Assange, and, you know, whatever we think of Julian Assange, you know, this is, it's not about the person, but let's look at the way in which we've seen WikiLeaks and whistleblowing being treated by the Obama administration. It's quite extraordinary. But all of the focus is on those things. But Sybil Edmonds, who is a whistleblower and presides over one of the most credible whistleblowing organizations in America, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. And she has something like 70-odd former federal government officials who've worked in national security. Over the, you know, many of them are veterans who've worked across government, you know, for 10 years, 20 years. All of them basically with insane stories of what has gone on inside the US government and how they've been retaliated against. I mean, so the stuff that she's bringing out really is actually extraordinary, and to the extent that one of her FBI supervisors has actually described the scandal as bigger than Watergate.
How could it be? I mean, we went there in 1997, or was it 1998 during Clinton, and we bombed this pharmaceutical company, saying it had to do with bin Laden. Well, during that period, after that period, we actually officially were meeting with bin Laden and bin Laden's group, which was never referred to as Al-Qaeda. It was always still Mujahideen. And to have this documented evidence that was gathered through counterintelligence operations that targeted Turkey. Now, the same thing, they had counterintelligence operation, not my division, but there was a large, and this was an official Pakistan division. And to say, and yes, this guy was wanted for these particular bombings, we bombed, but yet you have all this evidence, hard evidence. And again, it was not that some CIA faction, they let Mujahideen do that. In fact, indirectly helped. None of that. We officially, in official capacity, we were meeting with these individuals, with this group, all the way till 2001.
You mentioned this Caucasus operation and the Central Asian operations. What, in your view, was the objective of these meetings? Were these part of a wider operation linked to these Mujahideen networks in these countries? Was this, I mean, you mentioned the Cold War, and how that, you know, the Cold War mindset has become even more entrenched in different ways. Was this part of that?
It was, but first, like in the early part of second half of 1990s, in 1997, 1998, some of these operations involved actually bringing a lot of people, and included Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Afghanistan into Turkey. They were trained, and actually their passports were changed. They were given Turkish passports with NATO airplanes. They were taken to the operations that were being carried out. This was during all this Bosnia and Kosovo, and this was, again, official operations. It was not that, oh, these Mujahideens, they had their backpacks, and they found their ways through the borders, and they ended up in places like Albania. It's not. They came, and they came from Turkish, official NATO Turkish planes into certain Eastern blocs in Europe, and that's how they were brought in there.
Yeah.
So in 1997, 1998, there was a lot of those were concentrated on bringing these people into that block, the Balkans, and there was some focus there with all the together operations carried out through our Chechen channel there.
Yeah.
But then towards 1999, Azerbaijan became actually a hub that both included the stuff with heroin, but also it was organizing other smaller religious factions in other stands, in other countries like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And this was when Fethullah Gulen, which is his organization worth 20-some billion dollars, he's in the United States, his headquarters is in the United States, he's a Turkish, you know, religious figure. They opened more than 350 what they call madrasas. It's a different version of, it's not exactly the same madrasas the Wahhabis set up in Pakistan, but madrasas and mosques in all this country. Now, granted, in some of these countries that they were more siding with Russians, they kicked them out. They banned Gulens and all these madrasas. But many others, they didn't. So when that was happening, part of these madrasas, the religious schools as part of mosques, that's Gulen's movement, together with the U.S., NATO, Turkey factions were setting up in these countries. they had this very strong English language department. If you look at it, I mean, this is not top secret.
Yeah.
If you look at it, they emphasize English language. So you would see hundreds of English teachers, Americans, with diplomatic passports going to these countries to work for Gulen's madrasas, teaching English in religious schools.
Yeah.
And would you give diplomatic passports, Americans going there teaching English in madrasas? It's mind-boggling. But again, these were all done through official, implemented, formal channels. These were not, U.S. saw that some mujahideens or some people, big people from Saudi Arabia were pouring money into this, and Turkish Gulen was doing that, and they said, you know what, this is to our advantage. Hey, this is a great thing. Be like that. That's not the case. The whole implementation planning, from the planning stage to the implementation, were all taking place here via State Department in Washington, D.C. It was fully being communicated with the Turkish arm of NATO people, whether in military attaché or other military-related organizations in the United States with offices in NATO. So this was not, again, our enemies is our friend. That was not the case. And yeah. I know it's being reflected. So if my case would have been allowed to proceed in court, because I know the agents I worked with and I worked for, in fact, during closed meetings, some of these agents, they came and they told all this to these senators. They vouched for these reports, and they would have testified under oath. Or if the Congress would have deposed them, because initially Congress was going to have public hearings on my case. All these agents from the FBI, they would have told the truth because they were the good guys in this, FBI agents. But it didn't happen. The hearings were shut down because Congress was gagged in my case, because the CIA, the State Department, they didn't want that. The courts were shut down, and the media, initially during the first couple of years, some of these people, insiders, the agents from the FBI and even from some other agencies, including DEA, they were even willing to sit anonymously. I mean, they would be known to the reporters like New York Times, Washington Post, talk to them, but as long as their names were kept off the record, anonymously, they were cited. Not a single one of those meetings and what they gave these reporters were printed.
Yeah.
And after that, they knew you can't get this information out even if you wanted to.
We have to wish all of our Muslim friends happy Ramadan. Happy Ramadan.
Osama bin Laden.
Happy Ramadan.
Osama bin Laden.
Happy Ramadan.
Osama bin Laden.
Happy Ramadan.
Osama bin
Laden. Happy Ramadan. Happy Ramadan.
Long live
Osama bin Laden.
Long live Osama bin Laden.
Contributed to making a cult figure out of Osama
bin Laden.
See, Osama bin Laden,
his stated goal,
wants to destroy America.
At least he said it to me.
That's what I say to the American people. We've never seen this kind of evil before.
Why is there this this block on these issues which are so significant and critical to U.S. national security and what happened in 9/11? Why was there this strange and bizarre reluctance, and not just reluctance, but this active opposition to investigating these things, and in fact protection? What does that say about the American this American national security system?
Well, you see, that I call is the hardest question of all, because I mean it gets so frustrating to, I see, because I truly appreciate some of the 9/11 truth movement, but then it gets so frustrating to see all these different factions, and I have no idea how many of them are actually set up to be, discrediting factor in there. I mean, you get people who, it just only about a year ago I realized what in the world was this LIHOP, MIHOP,
yeah.
and people coming and saying, oh, you subscribe to whatever hop, and then this is the other hop, and that's the thing, because what I try to tell people, okay, is that you take all the stuff with the gag orders and what I know, you put together, you have written on this topic, okay? And your book also relies on heavily documented, sourced, right, information. You put together with what happened with, let's say, Colleen Rowley, okay? It's not a huge incident, you know, but you take that, put it together with Robert Wright, Agent Wright in Chicago. You get this thing that be still, it's so convoluted with the Abel danger. You bring all the stuff together and you look and say, it has nothing to do what we are being told about who did 9/11 and why and how we didn't know or the fact that we didn't know. Now, it's this thing that they're talking about LIHOP and MIHOP and all this, I would say, confusing versions and the theories and hypotheses that they're putting forth. I think that actually ends up taking away from the macro picture. Yeah. Because to say this thing of what make it happen, then you have to look at a lot of people that had to be in it with it, okay? If you ask my personal opinion, this is not an expert opinion. I would say, no, the people like from the top layer, second or third year, they did not make anything happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Now the top people, maybe the top layer, there are indications and so much evidence that they may have let it happen, even afterwards. Okay. If you see with Yasin Al-Qadi, and this is not under only Turkish division, because one of the things that people don't know about Yasin Al-Qadi, supposedly he escaped and he got out of the United States. The first place he went for a while was Albania. Hmm. But immediately after that, he went to Turkey.
Yeah.
Okay? And a lot of his banking and operations are all placed in Turkey. Again, you're coming to this Turkey, NATO ally Turkey. Is it some ally that is backstabbing us? Absolutely not. It's the other way around. It's the other way around. Turkey is serving the orders and the wishes and they carry out with the manual and the recipes of what they are given by their bosses, the NATO, US, UK bosses.
Yeah.
So you look at Qadi, ends up in Turkey. All these different bin Ladens and all these people from Saudi Arabia that were taken out. Did FBI agents in the counterterrorism divisions, at least the ones in Washington field office, were they fuming? Did they want to question these people? Absolutely. Who are these? Somebody says, no, you can't question these people. Hmm. And why? I mean, you can't go and say, here are these people. Then you say, no, you can't investigate these people. Then you look at all the other mysterious things. We are not capturing anyone that we can prove has any relation to 9/11. And the ones we say they are either dead or we make sure they are killed before they are out in the court.
Hmm.
I mean, you put all this stuff together and then say, okay, now look at this and start looking at it from this macro perspective. That is productive. That is getting us close to all these unanswered and questions about 9/11 that should lead us to a path that says, stand up, rise, and demand the further truth, but also justice based on that truth, which I don't think is going to happen. We are sitting here 40 years later, and we still don't have answers on Kennedy's assassination, for God's sake, okay?
Hmm.
And it's every day, and it's pessimistic, I know, but it looks more and more like this is going to be another one of those chapters in U.S. histories. When they come and they give you this official stories, and it even later throughout the years when bits and pieces of information comes out, it's either too late because people have given up, nobody listens, the media blacks it out, and it just goes nowhere. And you end up with this cult of people who say, here are all these facts. And that's what happens. We end up being this cult.
Absolutely. I mean, what I think is really powerful, though, about what you have done And the information that you're presenting is that, I mean, one, you don't get involved in all of that kind of theoretical speculation. But most importantly, what I think is interesting is that the stuff that you're talking about gives us a glimpse into a very different, almost parallel universe. I feel like I'm only halfway through the interview.
Well, we can absolutely schedule and have another one. So we can, schedule a second part 2 and go through other stuff if you have other questions.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd really appreciate that.
Well, that was part one of our Crisis of Civilization Sybil Edmonds podcast special. You can find more details about Sybil Edmonds and her book Classified Woman at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. You can read more of Nafiz's articles at his Cutting Edge blog, which is nafizahmed.com. He also currently writes an Earth Insight blog over at The Guardian, which you can search for at guardian.co.uk. I'm Dean Puckett, and you can find my work at deaddeanfilms.co.uk. And don't forget to go and check out our documentary, The Crisis of Civilization, at crisisofcivilization.com.
What happened?
There's a great deal of distrust of the United States around the world.
They see a continuum of the Crusades in every action as the West gains more power.
And their fear is that the United States is like a Goliath that can stride around the earth breaking things.
They don't all trust our motives.
We're also making life difficult around the world in a number of other countries. So,
as a consequence, recently we have not been doing very much real education, which is why there's so much cynicism, pessimism, apathy.
When Thomas Aquinas appeared on the Meeting of Minds shows, one of the many fascinating things he said was that he had learned a great deal from his enemies, by which he meant his philosophical opponents. We don't seem to be able to learn anything from our philosophical opponents.
And the danger is that many of us may start to equate Islam with the terrorists.
The anger, hatred, and rage we are feeling in our hearts as Americans.
Military might cannot reclaim what we have lost inside ourselves.
Hopefully, we will come away with as few lives lost as we can. We have already lost way too many.
For 200 odd years, this nation has counted on the military to defend itself against these sorts of threats. Well, now the threats are here, they're home.
What happened? I thought we lived in a safe playground of a world where my career was the only thing I had to think about. And suddenly, there's a larger, desperate, dangerous world. Explain it to me. What's it about? This isn't the world you promised me. This isn't the world you told me about. This isn't the world in which only private things count.